Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex, who have we got on today?
So today we have historian and best-selling author Miranda Kaufman, who's written the book Black Tudors, which I absolutely love. Miranda, hello.
Hello.
How are you doing? How's lockdown?
Well, I'm sitting here in sunny Wales. I've always worked from home, so that's a bonus. I'm basically feeling pretty blessed in my, spending a lot of time with my delightful children. Well, it's a pretty worrying time. Yeah, I have to kind of not watch the news most of the time.
I think it's just become so full of people's underlying motives as to why they're presenting a story a different way, especially when you see the stuff coming out of America, that it's just like, I just cannot be bothered to sit in on the row between Trump and the journalists. And I think the daily briefings, the government have kept them going, haven't they? Because the journalists said they wanted them, but they're not particularly useful on a daily basis anymore.
No, it's just all very worrying.
Let's talk just talk about history. Let's just go back into our little historian bubble then. So Alina, start us off with a question.
So how did you get onto the topic, this specific topic, as a historian?
Well, I suppose I was always fairly obsessed with the Tudors ever since primary school. I did history at Oxford and I wanted to carry on, and I was sort of trying to find something that nobody else had researched to look into. And I was in a lecture, so my mind wandered in a lecture. So I was in a lecture about early modern trade. It was pretty dry, but then suddenly the guy said, the Tudors started trading to Africa in the middle of the 16th century. And I was surprised because, I'd only ever heard about trade with Africa in the context of the 18th century slave trade.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, what was that like? What did the Tudors, who, we all think we know so well, what did they make of the Africans that they encountered on the Guinea coast? And what did those Africans make of, the likes of John Hawkins? Like any good student, I rushed off to the library and started reading around it, and quite quickly found these references to there actually being Africans in Tudor England and Scotland, not Tudor Scotland, Stuart Scotland. So I was really intrigued, but there wasn't a lot of details, so I had to find out more.
Which is how any good project gets really started as a historian. You can't find the book you want, you go, bugger it, I'm going to write my own. But Africans had been in Britain for a long time prior to the Tudors, hadn't they?
Yeah, in sort of different forms. And there were some Africans in Roman Britain, although they tend to be more North Africans. There was even a Roman emperor called Septimus Severus, who was born in Libya, although he probably wasn't of African descent. His wife might have been. So there are sort of patches here and there, but it is in the early modern Tudor period that the numbers are bigger, and they tend to be more from West Africa as well.
When you came to looking for Tudors, you found something like, when you were doing the book, nearly 400 individuals in the period, didn't you? How did the Black Tudors actually come to be in England?
I should stretch that the sort of 360 plus was up to, I looked up to 1640, so it's actually the early Stuart period as well. And probably for the specific sort of Tudor period, it was more like 200. So I kind of identified three main ways in which they came here. Firstly, from countries in southern Europe that already had relatively large black populations, like Spain, Portugal, and Italy, often in the entourage of royal figures like Catherine of Aragon or Philip II of Spain, or merchants, including some Jewish converso merchants from Portugal. Sometimes aristocrats as well. In the early 17th century, you have a female aristocrat bringing an African enslaved woman back from Venice with her in the 1620s. So that was one way. And then, going back to that early Tudor trade with Africa from the 1550s, you find groups of Africans often of quite noble birth being brought back to London, taught English, and then sent back out to Africa to work as trade interpreters and factors. And then this third way was privateering. So kind of legalized piracy, when the English were out capturing Spanish and Portuguese ships, they would quite often find Africans on board and bring them home. So it's all sort of part of England being kind of slightly peripheral to a much bigger, you know, bigger movements of people around the world, and specifically that the Spanish and Portuguese who had kind of got there first in a lot of these and endeavours.
So your book shows that the Black Tudor population spread across society, didn't it? They're also in the royal households.
Yes, that's perhaps sort of one of the most visible. So there are actually more Africans at the Scottish court of James IV than there were in any of the English courts. But we do see Africans, John Blank, who's the cover image for my book. It's the only known identifiable portrait of an African in Tudor England.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. So he's depicted twice, actually, in the Westminster tournament role of 1511, playing his trumpet. There were also Africans at the court of Elizabeth I, James I, Charles I. So, there's this sort of constant presence there.
And then at the completely other end of the scale, tell us about Anne Cobby, and where did you find your evidence of her? That's fascinating that you were able to find her.
So she's described as a single woman. She dies in Almondsbury in Gloucestershire in 1625. And we actually only have sort of one scrap of paper about her. I can't claim to have discovered it. It was already known to the archivists in Bristol, where it's kept, when I went there. So I think I must have heard, I think I must have read about it somewhere else, but I forget. But it is this, it's called an inventory. So if you died and you didn't leave a, no, even if you did leave a will, if you died and you had goods worth over a certain amount, sort of about £5, I think, people would appraise the value of your goods. So they would write a list of everything you owned and say how much it was worth, as part of the probate activities. And so that's what we have for her. She didn't leave a will, but we have a list of her goods. And it just says what she owned. And it doesn't ever include sort of land or property, I don't think. But anyway, it has sort of personal effects and property. So the most valuable thing she had was a cow that was worth just over £3. And then, it's sort of all her wearing apparel, various sort of cooking utensils, a pewter candlestick, various bits and bobs. And so it's just a little snapshot of life. And so I did quite a lot of kind of deep analysis of that, sort of trying to sort of milk would be the appropriate verb in the cow's context, I suppose, trying to milk every last sort of ounce of detail about what that could tell us about her life.
Mm. And there are lots of people in between, aren't there? Tell us about Jacques Francis. I love his story.
So Jacques Francis was a salvage diver working in Southampton in the 1540s. This is part, this is just sort of this fantastic, surprising sort of fact to some people that, in the early modern world, most white people couldn't swim, but people from Africa were actually very talented swimmers and divers, and their skills were sort of sought after, as pearl divers in the Caribbean, or in this case, in salvage divers. And, we've all heard of the Mary Rose when we do Tudor history, but we didn't know that Jacques Francis and possibly a couple of other African salvage divers actually dived down to the wreck to try and salvage some of the valuable guns within a couple of years after the ship sank.
That's amazing.
And the other really key thing about him in terms of history is that he's the first known African to testify in a English court of law.
That's right. Yeah, I remember reading that.
which is really, really significant in terms of legal status, because if enslaved people throughout history have not been allowed to testify in court. So the fact that he was a witness in this case, so he's working for a Venetian guy called Peter Paolo Corsi, who sort of is a, you know, organizes the whole salvage operation, and he's basically accused by some Italian merchants in Southampton. There were a lot of Italian merchants in early modern Southampton, but that's another story. But he's accused by this Italian merchants of stealing some tin from another wreck that they're working on. And so it all goes to court, and that's where we learn about Jack Francis, really, is from this court case.
What about Diego the...
Circumnavigator.
Yeah, that one, whatever she said.
The one that sailed around the world with Francis Drake. So yeah, I love this. Actually, someone on Twitter today, well, yesterday, was saying, you know, he's a firm favourite. And we really need a biopic of Diego. You know, the first scene of the movie would be, you know, in this in the early hours of the morning in July. Was it July 1572? You know, the English ships have docked in Nombre de Dios in Panama, and along the quay comes a running figure, and they shoot at him, but he keeps shouting and saying, "Please let me aboard, let me aboard." And they keep shooting at him, but eventually he persuades them their lives are in danger, and he tells them, you know, that they really the Spanish are heavily armed in the town, and if they don't stop their attack now, they're all going to get killed. And that's how Diego kind of inveigles his way onto Drake's ship. This is on an earlier raid of the Caribbean rather than the voyage around the world. That's how they meet, and then he brokers this amazing alliance, again, something that kind of doesn't fit with what we think we know. An alliance between Drake and his men and the Cimmeroons, who were African-seeded, escaped their enslavement by the Spaniards and set up their own settlements in the hinterland, and had been sort of regularly attacking the Spanish settlements for about 50 years by this point. And they launch an attack together and capture a whole load of treasure from the Spaniards that's being transported across the Isthmus of Panama on the back of mules. And that's how Drake makes his first fortune. And Diego goes back to England with him, and then serves as part of the crew on the circumnavigation voyage when they set out in 1577. But, you know, then the tragic denouement to the film is when he dies before they get home. He dies near the Moluccas in Indonesia. Of some arrow wounds that he sustained almost a year beforehand. And I haven't quite, possibly they termed gangrenous. It's not entirely clear. I think he's meant to have had like 20 arrow wounds, but he doesn't die immediately. He lives for almost another year. So, you know, and yeah, obviously it would have all the adventures of the voyage. I am fond of Diego.
Is he your favourite?
Oh, well, it's very difficult. It's like asking, you know, a mother to choose between their children, isn't it? I don't think I should take that analogy too far.
Again. Yeah.
I think all books are sort of children, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You definitely get book brain like you get baby brain.
It always depends, you know, which one you were into at the time, you know, what you were delving into. I really enjoyed learning more about sort of early West African history when I was looking at Prince Dedere Jokawa.
I was about to ask you about him, and I'm really glad you pronounced his name for me, so tell us about him.
Well, whether I pronounce it right is anyone's guess, and you know what we've got written down is in a parish record in London, in St Mildred Poultry. He was baptised on New Year's Day 1611, but what we've got written down is purely, you know, the parish clerk of the times attempt to write down the name that he was told. So, you know, what level of accuracy it has is anyone's guess. But he was a prince, the son of King Kadibia, apparently, of River Sestos in modern-day Liberia. And he's one of these young noble men who came to London for a couple of years to learn English.
sort of like an exchange student. But we know he lived with a merchant called John Davies in the city of London. We know a bit more about him. This was something I kind of stuck together, which I was quite happy with. But we knew about the parish register entry, but I found this reference in the East India Company letters, where an East India Company merchant called Edward Blytheman encounters this man again in Liberia in sort of 1614, so a few years later, and is surprised by how great his English is. It turns out it's the same guy. So we have that kind of other end of jigsaw puzzle that he did go back and he did interact with English merchants later on.
I think what your book shows us is that these people are working in society, that they're examples of people who are really being valued for their skills, and are they being paid accordingly?
There is evidence of various individuals being paid wages, yes. I think we have to remember as well that Tudor society, you didn't really have a salary in the way that you do now. It's sort of a different setup as well. Some sort of domestic servants would sort of have board and lodging, and then rewards or different forms of payment as well. They clearly are being compensated for their work.
So how did we then get from this kind of just sort of this natural acceptance of Africans arriving in Britain and going about their business and working in society? How do we get from that to the kind of attitudes that result in the slave trade? It's a big change, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a question I have fully answered, I don't think, but a lot of scholars are trying to think about it still. But arguably, in a way, almost it was the trade in enslaved Africans that then changed attitudes, hardened attitudes more. I think a key factor is greed. And when English people and Scottish people and Welsh people don't need them, and Irish, but when the British realised what fortunes could be made in the New World, in the Caribbean and in America, it became useful to,
yeah.
the only way that they could harvest those very high intense labor intensive crops was to enslave somebody. They tried indentured white labor. It didn't work very well eventually, and it just became but I think also they're following the Spanish and Portuguese example as well. They want an empire like the Spaniards. They want their own colonies, and the colonial model that they're looking at, is already involving African enslavement.
What kind of sources were you using? I mean, were they actually hard to find?
There was an element of needle and haystack type.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. Like I said, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, and in a way, part of what I was doing was bringing references together rather than finding things completely new. So I had a starting point. There's an organisation called the Black and Asian Studies Association, and a sort of pioneer of that called Marika Sherwood, when I was just starting out, sort of sent me a list of the references she was aware of at that time, which is about 100 individuals on that list. So I was able to kind of almost quadruple that by going back. So one of the major sources numerically are the parish registers of baptisms and burials and the odd marriage. Whereas that original list had sort of a reference to one baptism in a particular parish, I went back and read the entire parish register for the period and was able to sort of find, maybe the burial record of the person we already knew had been baptized, or just other African individuals in that parish. And then I would look at, the other parish registers for the same town, or, I certainly haven't read all the parish registers in the UK, but...
That would not be fun.
Well, I'm hoping they'll all get digitized.
Yeah, there's more and more of them creeping on, but it's just, again, it's like, because they're not centralised. Well, it's going to be a while.
The other problem is that actually a lot of parish registers are now digitised, either thanks to the Mormons or, you can get a lot of them on Ancestry or Find My Past. But what is not, when they've been transcribed, they haven't transcribed the kind of extraneous detail, which is what I want. So it might say John Smith, baptised on the 6th of June 1598. But they haven't bothered to transcribe the bit where it says John Smith, a Negro, or an Ethiop, or whatever. Yeah. And this is the same for any other social historian, because there's all sorts of other weird, wonderful details you find when you do read through these things. I think my favourite is this first known reference to British Sign Language. So this man who can't speak arrives at the church with a Bible in one hand and a woman in the other, and makes signs to the vicar to show that he wants to be married, and they have this wedding, which you find when you're reading through scanning through these things, but that stuff hasn't been transcribed in the digitization process, so. You can't really search for that kind of detail at present, which is annoying.
Absolutely. What was the weirdest thing you found?
The weirdest thing I found? I suppose the most surprising thing, again, kind of confounding our kind of assumptions about this whole subject, was this incident where an African called Edward Swarthy whips a white man called John Guy in a manor house in Gloucestershire in 1596. When I first called up the document, I was trying to read it. I saw the word whip and I assumed that it was the African man being whipped, but actually it was the other way around. That was quite surprising, but really fascinating.
You mentioned it when you were talking about Anne Cobby, but there is an issue, isn't there, when you were putting this book together about the scarcity of complete evidence. It's not like you would find a whole diary written by an African in England in the Tudor period.
Oh well, one day.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I think actually one of the more negative Amazon reviews on the book said something like, I read this book, had absolutely no information on the topic.
Okay. Do you know what? My favourite ones are the ones where they start with, I haven't read this book, but, and then they give you one star. They're my personal favourite.
Hopefully that won't put anyone off reading.
Yeah.
So it's very fragmentary and a sort of jigsaw puzzle. Encouragingly, some of the school teachers I've been working with to try and get this into the classroom say that the students actually quite enjoy that because it kind of, shows them the kind of detective work involved in history in general, and they feel that they like the idea of trying to do that.
No, that is cool. Is there anyone you've looked at where there just wasn't enough to put them in the book, but there was something like tantalizingly you were so close to finding something good, but you were just like, I just don't have enough?
I do try and squeeze them into the book somewhere. as a kind of point of contrast or whatever.
But I know I've done it with soldiers in my war books where I'm like, there's no justification really for me putting this in, but I just like them and I want them in there. So I don't care that it's ropey and I don't really have a lot to say. I want them in there.
Yeah, and since I've written it, people have sent me snippets as well. I mean, have I got this right? Someone sent me, they translated or they knew of a translation of a Hungarian visitor to Tudor England. He sort of wrote a journal and he said he was sort of walking around the countryside and this African man came out of the wood with an axe or something. And he was, quite scared. But the guy started talking to him and had an English accent and had clearly lived here his entire life and was very friendly. And it's just this fantastic sort of random encounter. And I think that's it. I think that's one of the things I'm trying to show is that it's sort of the ordinariness of this and those lives, and they were here.
Yeah. Did you have problems with terminology? Like you mentioned that sometimes they're described as like an Ethiop or an African, or is there like a, is there people standardizing whether people are Arab and African into the same thing, or have you got to be wary of that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the more tricky words is Moor, M-O-O-R, or, well, sometimes M-O-R-E, anyway, which is used very vaguely sometimes in this period and kind of be attached to pretty much to a lot of different sorts of people, although there's often a kind of prefix, you know, they might call, say, an Indian Moor or a, but yeah, it was very vague. Tudor geography was not brilliant, and
a lot of the world map was still like, here be dragons though, wasn't it?
So it is one of the problems, but yeah, I did my best.
You once said that you were anxious because people might not like the book. It's a great book. Why were you worried?
Gosh, where have we got that from?
It's a very serious interview. Well, they made it sound very serious in The Guardian when the book came out, I think.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I wasn't on my best form that day, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think most authors are scared that people won't like their book, aren't they? I don't know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I suppose in all seriousness, there's perhaps a fear that
we're having yesterday a great friend of ours, Emma Southern, who does the Romans, was having a problem on Twitter with a lot of men basically giving her the now little girl speech, because she challenges assumptions about the Roman Empire, and she talks about things like ethnicity and gender, and it challenges the norm of what people are used to. And I suppose, was there a fear when you were writing and sort of saying, look everybody, there were all these black people living in Tudor England and they weren't slaves? Was there a worry that people might have, I don't know, do people react negatively when you challenge things with work like this? I think it's awful if they do.
I suppose I haven't had as much negative feedback to my face as you might suggest, think that you might, you know, I haven't really got a full army of trolls.
That's good.
Hearing on Twitter, who knows what people say, you know, behind their back, I don't know. I think there are a few, I suppose there's always the issue of being white and writing black history. I think there is sometimes that kind of feedback that, you know, this isn't your story to tell.
Yeah.
But, you know, for every one person who said something like that to me, you know, 10 people have been like, we're so grateful that you have unearthed this stuff that we didn't know about. And it, you know, we kind of felt like it must be true, but we didn't know. And I think it can be really valuable to challenge those assumptions, because especially sort of when people think about a black history and they just always assume that the African people were enslaved, you know, throughout Western history, and that's very damaging in a lot of ways, I think.
But it's great that this book has led on to like the work that you do with schools and things in terms of raising the profile of ethnicity in England, like in the early modern period, isn't it?
Well, I hope so. Working on that. I've spoken at some of the main teaching history conferences in the country, and currently got a mailing list of almost 250 teachers who are, you know, keen on teaching black tutors, and we're working on teaching resources and lesson plans and schemes of work is a phrase that I've learned from my teacher friends, but it just means a series of lessons. And people are sharing that, and yeah, it's quite a lively discussion on Twitter as well, and so, you know, good stuff, and trying to progress that, which is really great.
And you're actually involved in a project, aren't you, involving young writers?
Yeah, so that's a slightly different, so that's where Diego comes in again, because this is called Colonial Countryside, and it's working with the National Trust and the University of Leicester Creative Writing Department and school children, so 10-year-olds, and there are adult creative writers and these 10-year-olds from local schools, and there are 10 National Trust properties which have some kind of colonial history, connections with India or the Caribbean, And these young people who are often from those sorts of backgrounds themselves are confronting those histories, learning about them, writing short stories or poems or personal essays inspired by that. And these adult creative writers are doing that too. And it's been really amazing to see the work that's come out of that. But Diego's, one of the properties is Buckland Abbey near Plymouth. In Devon. And that was owned by Francis Drake for some time. So they've told Diego's story there. They had a temporary exhibition about the circumnavigation voyage last year, I think, that sort of featured Diego. It was really great to work with them on that. There's lots coming out of that. You can follow them on Twitter or just search for Colonial Countryside. And the Twitter account has got videos of some of these young people reading their poetry, and it's great. It's a really great project.
It really is. I'm really excited about because you've changed direction now with your research. I'm really excited to hear more about what you're doing now. So you're working on Caribbean heiresses, aren't you?
Yeah. So again, this is something that's been on the back burner for a while, and it has got that overlap, I suppose, with Colonial Countryside because of this kind of country houses element. A lot of these heiresses lived in those kinds of houses, and that's actually how I came to the subject in the first place, because back in 2006, ahead of the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade, I was commissioned by English Heritage to do a survey of their properties, links with slavery and abolition, and I worked with a historian called Madge Dresser. She came up with sort of 12 different potential ways a house might be linked. I suppose the most straightforward one you would assume is someone owns a plantation or is a trader in enslaved Africans themselves, and those profits have built the house or bought the house. But there were actually quite a lot of other sort of more indirect ways, like they could be a merchant trading in sugar or indigo or tobacco or a plethora of other slave produced goods, or they could be involved in the legal battles but the thing that caught my imagination was the heiress story. So the house could have been built or bought with money that had been brought in by marrying a wealthy woman whose money had come from enslavement. So one of these properties is Battle Abbey in Sussex, built on the site of the Battle of Hastings. So
yeah,
it's like right, the center of the English history myth, 1066. She was Elizabeth Vassal, and she was an heiress to sort of three Jamaican sugar plantations, and much older Godfrey Webster married her. And she went to live at Battle Abbey, but she's got a crazy story. They get divorced, she has lovers, she has a second husband. Both these men take her maiden name to try and lay claim to the Jamaican money. When she eventually divorces the first guy, he then commits suicide. But at some point she fakes one of her daughter's deaths in order to try and keep her. Because in those days, if you got divorced, the husband got the children.
That's right, yeah.
So it's this crazy. So yeah, she's in Italy at the time, and she sort of buries a dead goat in a coffin at the British Embassy and hides her daughter away in some kind of convent. Anyway,
outstanding.
It's quite high drama craziness. I'm enjoying looking into that.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming on to talk to us about Black Tudors and about what you're working on now as well. It's been really interesting, and I really like that you're managing to sort of tell more about Britain's ethnic history as well, because it doesn't get done enough.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of people working on it, so yeah. I'll give you some ideas of who you can interview next.
Perfect, thanks very much.
Join us tomorrow. It's our 100th episode already, and we will be talking to John Nicol about his fantastic new book, Lancaster, about the greatest aircraft ever made. I'm not having it on any other aeroplane. It wins, hands down, and you'll find out why. You can now nominate History Hack for an award. If you go to britishpodcastawards.com, you can nominate us for a Listener's Choice Award. You have to do your vote by the 6th of July 2020, and they will announce the winner at the British Podcast Awards on Saturday, the 11th of July 2020. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd really appreciate it. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower.
And I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.